wanted to talk here tonight about where the evolution of my thinking has gone over the 10 years or so that I've been really kind of a full-time activist and have been really focused on this kind of work. And, you know, in that time, I've given a lot of talks and things, and people often ask, like, what's the one most important thing that you think everybody should be doing? Or, like, what's the thing that people really need to understand to do this work, or that sort of thing? And I always resisted those questions because the answers are so broad and complex, and there are so many answers, and I think people need to be doing so many different things. But over time, there has emerged to me something that is so central to so many of our movements, not just the climate movement, but a lot of our progressive movements, and so critical to doing this work that I do feel like it's something that we all at least need to be talking about in order to do this work effectively and to survive in doing it for long. And that is shame, which I think we don't talk about very often and we don't understand all that well, but I actually think it's one of the most important shaping forces in our movement right now, and one of the things that is really paralyzing us from being more effective, and one of the things that has become really toxic in a lot of our movement spaces and communities, and something that I realize there's no easy answers to, which is part of why we avoid talking about it sometimes. That one, sometimes people feel like, well, there are things we should be ashamed of, you know, that look at this world that we have created and what we've done to it. You know, look at these systems of white supremacy that we have allowed to exist for so long. Look at where we've brought our planet, climate, and ecological crisis. And I think there we muddy the water sometimes between guilt and shame. And so that's the first thing that I think is important to clarify, that shame is different than guilt. That guilt is about recognizing a bad thing that we have done. And it involves sort of turning away from that, like recognizing that bad action and deciding to turn from that and turn in a different direction. But shame is about saying that we are bad people, that who I am fundamentally is a bad person, which actually prevents the turning away from that bad behavior. It says, this is fundamentally who you are, and that's never going to change. And so it prevents us from saying, we're not going to be that way anymore. And that was one of the big lessons that I learned when I was in prison. That's where I feel like I learned the most about shame, was in my 2 years in prison, because our prison system is really like a manufacturing system for shame. Like if you were going to design a social structure to manufacture shame, you would build something like the prison system that's built on separating people and alienating people from a broader community, and built on defining people by their mistakes, defining people as felons, as criminals, as an identity. And the prison system is pretty effective at creating shame. And I saw that where a lot of people would come into that system who maybe had been engaging in some destructive patterns and destructive actions, both destructive for themselves or for their communities. And getting into that system sort of was a wake-up call for them. And early on in the first couple of months, I'd see people that are like, man, I'm really going to make a change. I'm going to turn this around. And I saw that over time, people would internalize that message of shame from the prison system and say, well, this is who I am. This is the only thing I'm ever going to be able to do. Like, I know that I'm never going to be accepted back in society again. I'm always going to be defined by this crime or by this mistake. And so this is really the only place for me. And that's why we have such a high rate of people cycling in and out of the prison system over and over and over, because they're separated from society and shown that they're always going to be separated. And so that distinction there between guilt and shame is, I think, critical, because shame prevents change. It's, I think, one of the most counterproductive motivations for changing people. And that's a lesson for our movement, because we often think that shame is a strategy for changing our opponents. Sometimes say, like, how can we shame this corporation into changing, or how can we shame this politician into changing? And, you know, I mean, first off, it's absurd to talk about shame for a corporation, because a corporation can't feel that. They're not human beings, they're not people. But even for individuals within that corporation, or for politicians, it's still counterproductive, I think, to approach things saying, we want to shame this person, because what we're protesting in the first place is shameful behavior, right? We're certainly seeing that on display in Washington more and more and more every day, right? Like, more shameful behavior. And I've always been kind of a literalist. And when I think about, like, shameful behavior, that it's behavior that's full of shame, and if we then respond to that, try to protest that shameful behavior by shaming people and heaping more shame on them, we're going to get more shameful behavior, right? We're filling them with ever more shame and reinforcing that behavior. But it gets more complicated, I think, when we're not talking about our opponents in movement work, but we're talking about looking inward at our own communities and the shaming that we do to each other. Because there we're talking about some of our own traumas that we bring into this work and into our movement spaces, which I think all of us do. Like, we live in a traumatizing world, right? You know, we can see that in a million different ways. I think our society, our economy that we've built, is built to be dehumanizing and alienating, you know, certainly for some populations more than others, more overtly dehumanizing. But I think all of us bring some degree of brokenness and trauma into any of the movement spaces that we come into. And part of how we heal from that, right, is by sharing that in common space and holding collectively these traumas that we bring and connecting with empathy with each other. And in that empathy, we're really, like, feeling each other's pain as we make space to listen to the stories that everyone brings into our communities and into our movement spaces. We're feeling that pain that other people have experienced directly in our lives, in their lives. And that's part of what deepens our own perspective on doing this work, that while each of us might bring our little bit of trauma from our own direct experience, there might be different populations that have had radically different experiences, and they're bringing their own pain. And that's deepening our perspective of the ways in which our society is so messed up and the challenges that we face. And so that connecting is critically important, and that connection happens through empathy. But the thing about empathy is that we are, in some ways, like at a neurological level, actually experiencing that pain and that trauma through empathy. And that's been something that scientists have learned recently about our neurobiology, that we have something called mirror neurons, that when we see someone else having a painful experience or a joyful experience or whatever, when we see someone else's experience, our mirror neurons are basically doing the exact same thing neurologically as if we were actually having that experience that we are witnessing. That our brains, if we see someone else get hit in the arm and we know what it feels like to get hit in the arm, we know that that's painful, our brains kind of carve the same neural pathways as if we had actually been hit in the arm, which is a phenomenal thing, but also in some ways a dangerous thing. And there's actually been a lot of research around people that their day jobs require them to witness a lot of trauma and a lot of painful experience. People that are in healing professions or people that are social workers and get a lot of direct experience of really painful and traumatic experience from others, they get that neurological burnout that happens when our brain is forming those mental pathways and basically forming the same thing that trauma does in the brain. And what trauma does in the brain is it forms sort of superhighways of neural connections that sort of funnel everything we experience then into those neural pathways. that when we keep reliving that traumatic experience, it's sort of like carving deeper ruts in our road, in our mind, to the point that we get stuck in that, and that all the things we see remind us of that trauma. And when it's our own trauma that we've actually experienced, we can process that over time, right? There are lots of therapeutic ways of addressing the trauma that we've experienced so that we don't do the two main things that trauma that's unprocessed manifests as, which is one, distorting our view of what's in front of us so that we no longer see what's really in front of us or the people that are really in front of us. We see what's behind us in that traumatic experience. And two, that we pass it on. That hurt people hurt people is one of the main lessons of this, that trauma begins a cycle where we hurt others. And as I said, when it's our own and we know the experience that actually caused that trauma, we can address that experience. We can try to right that wrong in various ways. We can build up our own protections against that trauma in our brain, where we can remember that was a past experience that we actually had, and it's not what's happening right in front of us. But I think what happens when it's not our trauma, when it's not actually our experience, that we have internalized the trauma of other people that we listen to, which in, as I said, in certain healing professions and, you know, with nurses or chaplains or social workers, they're getting better at realizing that that's what happens, that they see this all the time. But in movement spaces where we pay attention and refuse to turn away from the atrocities of the world, refuse to turn away from our brothers and sisters that are suffering in various ways, I think we actually have that frequent experience of witnessing other people's trauma as well. And when it's not ours, it becomes that neural pathway in our brain, that superhighway, becomes really hard to unpack. We still do the same thing mentally that trauma does, where whatever we see triggers that traumatic memory, and then we project that past onto what's in front of us. But we don't actually have our own experience to help ground us in the fact that that's not really what's in front of us, that is what happened in the past. And so carrying around other people's trauma, I think, is then how we start to hurt each other in movement spaces. And I think that's where that trauma that we have internalized from other people through empathy, we then weaponize into shame to hurt others, where there are things reminding us of whatever that systemic trauma was, when we're talking about these structural violences within our society that all of us are connected with in some way. So it's easy to remind each other and trigger each other of those structural violences. We don't really have any way of processing that, so we just attack each other in that way. But one of the lessons that has been learned very recently, both in neuroscience and in those professions that deal with a lot of trauma as part of their day job, is that there's a way to get out of that empathetic reaction to someone else's pain without it burning that neural pathway in our own mind. And that is compassion. And compassion is related to empathy. And we often talk about them in the same way. But empathy is like feeling with someone else, like feeling what someone else is feeling. And compassion is more like feeling for someone. And they're actually in completely different sides of our brain. They're in a completely different area. And when you're feeling compassion for someone, you're recognizing that it's not your trauma, that it's someone else's trauma, that they're the ones who had this experience. And the things that get us into that compassionate mindset are things like well-wishing for someone else, or like praying for someone else, or sending good energy to someone else, where you're recognizing that it's this person's suffering, and we can connect to it through empathy, but we can't linger in that empathy to the point that we internalize it. We got to make that transition into compassion so that we don't get stuck in those cycles. And I'd imagine that a lot of you who spent time in a lot of our social movements have seen where those toxic cycles of shame manifest and have seen what that looks like and just how destructive it can be. In my own experience, I've seen that paralyze organizations and shut down organizations. That's a big reason why Peaceful Uprising doesn't exist anymore. The organization that that I was a part of in Utah, it fell into these patterns, and people had done such violence to each other that they didn't trust each other in the high pressure actions that they were doing, the direct actions. So people didn't have the trust to do direct actions together. This is sort of the other reason that this is such a critical issue for activist movements, especially at this time, and especially on issues like climate change, is that what is called from us at this time, our responsibility, the actions that we need to take, require so much trust for each other. We are called to take such strong, bold actions to stand up to incredibly powerful forces. And that demands that we have, one, such strong grounding and personal resilience, but perhaps even more so, that we have such strong relationships in our activist communities and such trust that will allow us to withstand all the pressure that we know we're going to get from our enemies. We know we're going to get repression now more so than ever in our movements. We're seeing that in a variety of ways with all the new anti-protest laws that are being passed against pipeline activists, these critical infrastructure laws that criminalize dissent and make it a severe felony. And, you know, we saw even really with Standing Rock as sort of a turning point in the environmental movement, climate movement, where, you know, over the years leading up to that, we had been building a stronger movement that was growing to the point of actually being threatening to those power structures. And so it was met with violent repression there at Standing Rock, which then was traumatizing for a lot of the people who were there. And so it's those cycles of trauma that need to be interrupted in our movement communities and healed rather than exacerbated and continued, because there are more fights continuing to go on. You know, what spun out of Standing Rock was this resistance to every new pipeline, basically, that's being built in this country, and lots of sustained resistance campaigns like the Millennial Valley Pipeline in West Virginia and Virginia that has had a lot of truces and sustained blockades and a lot of resistance there that just won another victory this past week as the permit for that pipeline was rescinded. Places like Louisiana that have been fighting the Bayou Bridge Pipeline that is the other end of the Dakota Access and have been facing severe repression there and facing the first use of these critical infrastructure anti-protest laws, where people are being charged with felonies just for being in the vicinity of where this company is operating. We're seeing it really all over where these battles have spread. And that was sort of one of the mandates as the Standing Rock camp was being split up, was sort of take this struggle everywhere, take it back to your own communities and the threats that are being faced there. And so people are doing that, which is tremendous to see that we're at that level of sustained, committed resistance. But it means that the ties that bind us really need to be stronger than ever, and that our resilience to all of the threats that we face, whether those are external or internal, really need to be stronger than ever. And I think that's a challenge that's not going away, you know, as we're going to face more political authoritarianism for the foreseeable future, and as we are going to struggle with increased hardships from the climate crisis for generations to come. This is not going to get any easier. And so we're really going to have to step up our game in totally new ways that go way beyond just innovative strategies and tactics, but that bring us to much more solid and loving ways of being in our communities. That's really our biggest priority right now. And it needs to happen as we're continuing to engage in this fight. It's very much a praxis cycle here where, you know, we can't afford to all go on a big retreat together for a year. I was talking with Leslie earlier that I've been working with some Gandhians recently, and they reminded me that Gandhi, you know, when he started pulling people into the ashram to train for their revolutionary nonviolence, they trained in that ashram for, I believe it was 17 years before they ever even began their nonviolence campaigns. And sometimes it seems like, geez, that's what it would take to be as grounded as we really need to be, but we don't have those 17 years, you know? We need to be building this on the fly, you know, which is why I think we can't afford to just copy the models from anything in the past. You know, part of the reason that repeating the strategy of Gandhi is not good enough is that everybody was just following the one dude. And our challenges are greater than that. And so we need more people stepping up in leadership and not just following each other, but really everyone taking responsibility for our communities and our movements in this way. That's both a daunting challenge and I think a really exciting one. Something that I see from two communities that I've been able to watch a lot. One is baby boomers and the other is Unitarian Universalists. And sometimes there's a lot of overlap. And particularly like since I moved to New England with Unitarian Universalists in the Boston area where they're really comfortable, this has been true. That the baby boomer generation achieved the goal of comfort and convenience that was sort of the promise of our capitalist economy. They've largely achieved that goal for a broader section of the population in terms of material wealth and consumption. They achieved that goal more than any other generation in the history of humanity ever has. And from my perspective, those people within the baby boomer generation, that majority of them, they really dove into that consumer mentality, didn't seem to work for them on a deep level. The baby boomers that I know that seem to have the deepest internal contentment and actual fulfillment and happiness in their lives are the ones who avoided that path and found their own path of dissent and radicalism that they might have avoided some of that comfort and might have had some more material hardships, but it seems to have been much more fulfilling for them to actually keep themselves in the struggle. And I've witnessed the same thing with Unitarians that tend to be a well-off, comfortable community that sometimes get lost in that comfort and doesn't seem to be fulfilling for them on a deep level. And where I've seen the greatest, not just spiritual depth, but the greatest joy in any Unitarian community that I've experienced was in Salt Lake City, in my Unitarian church there, where it was really a besieged church. It was like they didn't exactly have a moat around the church, but it felt like it sometimes. Because they were legitimately persecuted by the dominant religion there in Utah with the Mormonism and by the extremely conservative culture there. And it was that church there was a hotbed of activism where most progressive movements had at least one foot there in that church community. But it was also just by far the most joyful Unitarian church that I've ever seen. And when I moved to New England and started at Divinity School, and the other Unitarian Universalist students would joke about how Unitarian Universalists can't sing, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, we can in Utah. People love it. That's half the reason why people come to church. It's because we sing great. And some of the shared common songs in Unitarian Universalism, like a song called Spirit of Life, which was written in the 1980s by an activist who was fighting U.S. imperialism in Latin America and was facing a lot of demoralizing setbacks in that movement, as a lot of people were flat out killed by American imperialism there. She wrote this song called Spirit of Life, and when we'd sing it in Utah, it would just like echo through the whole building and feel like so powerful. And the first time I heard it sung in the Boston area, I was like, song sounds vaguely familiar. I wonder if I've heard it before. And it was like halfway through that I was like, oh wait, this is the same song, just without any real spirit. And so I've had that experience where in the heart of that struggle we find the best parts of ourselves. And I think that's very true of the times that we're in right now and of the times that we're headed towards with the escalation of the climate crisis. And so I think that bad news that we're facing is not all bad news, because there's a part of our nature that I think was designed to shine in the darkest times. And so I'm excited to be a part of a movement that is moving into that. And I hope that we can live up to these times and pull out the best parts of ourselves. Thank you. I'm not sure how much time we have, but I'm sure we've got a good amount of time for questions. If anybody has any questions about anything I've said tonight or anything else that you may happen to know or wonder about me. Yes, back there.
Techniques of resistance. Two of the most common are just protest, direct action, and litigation in courts. Mm-hmm. Third one being a boycott, where you could compare two similar companies or products and decide, I'm not going to buy this, I'm going to buy from a different company that has slightly better ethical standards, thereby diverting money. Those are three things that anybody can participate in. I'm wondering, how in the world did you come up with that ingenious idea of going to a Bureau of Land Management auction and pretend like you were a buyer? How did you pull that off? Who thought of it? And how can we expect to be treated after pulling off a similar stunt?
In terms of how I thought of it, you know, it was in some degree spontaneous. I'd been preparing myself in a general way to engage in that level of civil disobedience. I'd been studying social movement history at the time and had been getting more and more involved in climate change and seeing the contrast between any successful social movement in our history and where the climate movement was at that time, which, as Leslie was alluding to, was really focused on appeasement of those at the top of our power structure and pushing this like non-threatening message of saying we can just have this cleaner, greener version of the world that we have now and keep everything else about it the same. And I saw that any of our successful social movements had a way more idealistic vision and had been way more confrontational and threatening to that power structure and threatening to really destabilize the whole system in order to get some concessions from that system. So I saw the need for more confrontational tactics and had been building up the commitment in myself to do it and building up a very small support network of literally just a handful of people, four or five people that were sort of going through that process that I was going through, and it said, you know, like, if you do something, we'll have your back. And so I was ready in that general way. And when this auction came around, it seemed like as good of an opportunity as any for a lot of reasons. That it was a confluence of a few issues that were pertinent there in Utah. For me, was the biggest motivation was the climate crisis and this like drill now, think later mentality. But it was also had a lot of a connection to public lands, which are so salient in Utah for a really long time and so contentious, and about participatory democracy as well, that this was public property where the public had largely been locked out of the decision-making process. And so it seemed like as good of an opportunity as any to show up and do something. And I'd been showing up to lots of other stuff at that time, whether it was protests or rallies or hearings, and looking for an opportunity to be powerful. And generally leaving feeling like, well, I don't really think it made any difference. But just showing up. And, you know, one of those hearings that I remember showing up to in the months before that auction was about some clean energy bill in Utah. And I remember showing up and the room was packed with people who were supportive of this clean energy bill. There were five lobbyists from our utility company there. And the chairman of the committee said, so how many people are here to support, to give testimony in support of this bill? And like 60 hands went up. And he said, and how many people here give testimony in opposition to this bill? And the five hands of those lobbyists went up. And the chairman said, well, then, you know, in the interest of time and fairness, we'll take, say, five people from each side to give testimony there. And so all the lobbyists got to speak, and really only the professional activists that among those 60 got to speak. And that was not me. And, you know, I was just like some random college student. And, you know, the other people in opposition to that bill were like, no, 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 we'll speak for you. And nobody said anything like what I wanted to say. And so I went away from that feeling really enraged and frustrated. And I remember on the way home, a friend of mine who had come with me, she had said, have you ever heard about these people called the Yes Men? I was like, well, no, I haven't. She's like, you know, they're these people who pretend to be those powerful figures like the WTO or like these corporations. You know, they pretend to be the people who are given a voice in these kind of situations. And so I like went home and looked them up and saw some videos and things of them pretending to be the WTO or, you know, pretending to be ExxonMobil and getting the opportunity to speak at these huge conferences or public events or whatever as their opposition and sort of exposing the real ideology of what their opposition really stands for. And I was like, wow, that's brilliant. You know, like the next time I'm in a situation there where we're not supposed to have a voice and they say like, are you part of the side that is supposed to have a voice here? I'm going to say yes. I wish I had just said that I was in opposition to it and gone up there and talked about what opposing this bill really means in terms of condemning our civilization to an unlivable future so that we can extract some short-term profit for a handful of us. And so then I went to this auction, and there were some people protesting quietly outside, holding signs, and ran into some people that I knew, and I said, well, inside where things are happening, let's go in there and see what we can do. And they're like, no, there's security. They'll just drag you out at the door. And I said, okay, well, then let's go get dragged out at the door and at least make that statement with our actions. And they're like, no, we can't do that. And so I went up to the front door, and rather than drag me out, the security said, are you here for the auction? And I said, well, yes, I am. And he directed me to a table, and the official at that table said, are you here to be a bidder? And I said, well, yes, I am. Still thinking like, well, that's just how I'll get inside and I'll be able to do something. Like I'll be able to like make a speech or like stand up and yell something or like, you know, lock myself to something. Or it was right after that guy had thrown a shoe at Bush. You know, I was like, maybe I can throw a shoe at somebody. Like, I don't know, but I'll do something. And got inside and, you know, they had given me like the big number 70 as my auction paddle and this packet of information. And I was able to sign up with like my real name, said I represent myself, just sign up right there on the spot. And then got inside the auction room and it was already underway and saw how things were operating. It was just like a comedy of a auction where a dude in a cowboy hat's up front talking really fast. And he's like, I got two over there, 250 over there, you know. And first I saw just how cheap these things were going for. I mean, they started at $2 an acre and some were sold for $2 an acre. Most of them were going for $8 to $10 or $12 an acre.
With the bid rigging?
Yes.
You exposed a tremendous amount.
Yeah. And so I was like, you know, this is outrageous. And I saw like, it's so vulnerable. Like I can just this whole thing up. And so then it was like a little bit of time to weigh that decision. You know, I was like, if I do this, you know, I'm probably gonna have to like, I don't know, declare bankruptcy and go to prison for a while. And, you know, I'll probably be in prison for a couple of years. Like, could I live with that? And I thought like, yeah, it would suck, but I could live with that. And if I don't do this, if I see this opportunity to potentially have an impact here and I don't take it, because I'm afraid of the consequences, and I continue to watch things unravel and the climate crisis exacerbate over the rest of my life, and 30 years down the road, I meet some young people that are born into this broken world facing unimaginable hardships, and I knew that I had an opportunity to do something about it back in 2008 and I didn't take it, could I live with that? And that's the question that I wrestled with for maybe like 20 minutes or so, and finally decided like, no, I really couldn't live with that. And so that's when I decided I had to act, and first started doing it just by driving up those prices. And I would wait for it to get down to one bidder where it was like going once, going twice. And then I'd jump in and start driving it up, and I'd kind of like watch the other bidder, like trying to play poker and see when it seemed like they were getting close to their maximum bid, and I would get out before I won anything. And that was being somewhat effective. I mean, there were, you know, parcels that I remember that were going once, going twice at $17 an acre. And I jumped in and started driving them up and would just keep bidding with the guy. And I got out at $240 an acre, and the other guy won the parcel. And that's for a parcel of 2,000 acres. And so I'd be like, wow, I just cost that oil company like $400,000 in 10 minutes. Like, this is the most effective thing I've ever done in my life. But still thinking like, but it's still a good deal for them, apparently, at 240, you know, which was showing that they were rigging the process, certainly. But like, it was, they were still going to develop that oil. And so when the auction got to the halfway point where half of the parcels had been sold, I said, I can't keep letting them win. I need to win the rest of the parcels. And so then I started bidding to win and won 14 parcels in a row before they stopped it. And, you know, I'd gone in with that mindset of like, I'm going to make a speech or yell something or throw a shoe at somebody. And so I wasn't trying to be particularly subtle. Like, when you bid, all you got to do is like flick your card a little bit. And I started being more bold with the way that I was raising my card each time. I was holding it like above my head. And then I stopped bringing it down in between bids and was just holding it up there constantly. So they stopped the auction and took me in. But yeah, in terms of how I thought of it, I basically prepared myself to do something bold and effective and committed myself to doing something bold and effective and kept showing up and testing the water until I found something. And I think that's important for all of us to be doing. You know, one of my favorite quotes about organizing is from Cesar Chavez, who said that when we were really well organized with the farm workers, being well organized for us didn't mean that we're all doing the same thing and just doing what one person says. But being well organized for us meant that we were all pushing on this wall in our own way and looking for a soft spot that yielded. And when somebody found a soft spot, we would focus more energy there. And when somebody found a crack, we could all push together and open that crack up and get through that wall. And I think that is something that's more important now than ever, where one, we're in such an unprecedented situation. Like, nobody really knows what to do. Nobody has ever stopped a climate crisis before. You know, nobody has ever overthrown corporate rule to the degree that we need to before. And so people like might have an idea, but nobody really knows what's the right thing that's going to be effective. And that situation is changing all the time. You know, and as much as we might be learning from our movement in what has worked in the past or what hasn't worked in the past, our enemies are learning from our movement too. They're studying our movements. They're hiring strategists and analysts to look at how we've been able to be effective and always looking for ways that they can innovate to prevent us from being effective again. Now, that's what a lot of private security companies are making their money off of right now. And so that means we need as much creativity as possible. And the only way to do that is to empower as many people as possible to take initiative and to follow their own ideas and to experiment and to look for their own opportunities of how to be effective. Yeah.
You were talking about the baby boomers who actually, as you said, have had this amazing life. And I wondered whether or not you've ever found any way of communicating to these very comfortable people that might motivate them beyond playing golf or something, because it's like they have benefited probably the most of anybody from where we've come. And I can say they just because I was born during the war as opposed to after the war. But it seems like there's a huge power there if they could open their hearts and sort of see how they could actually be elders in that historic sense of the word, of, you know, being the holders of knowledge and the pushing things forward. And I just wondered if you've ever had any message that might get through.
No. Of all my failures, getting through to comfortable boomers is my greatest, you know, with one exception, and that is when I was in Utah. The folks who came together to form Peaceful Uprising and to support me and to encourage more of the same, by and large, weren't already climate activists, weren't activists of any kind beforehand, by and large. And one of the single biggest demographic factors of folks who were most committed during that period before I went to prison were women around my mother's age.
How old's your mother?
63. And as close as I can tell, it was because they were able to associate me with their own kids and saw that I was legitimately in over my head. You know, I hadn't planned this action out. You know, I didn't have like an exit plan or a support structure lined up, you know, or like all the things that are good practice to do before you do a civil disobedience action. And I really needed help. You know, things would have been much uglier for me and much less effective if I didn't have a really amazing support network that just emerged out of nowhere and supported me in big ways for a long time. And I'm incredibly grateful for that, because I see a lot of people that stick their neck out and don't get that kind of support. And so I saw that, like, that actual vulnerability was the one way I've ever been able to get through to that comfortable boomer audience. And that's hard to replicate. You know, part of my critique for a long time, when I first kind of got a big voice in the climate movement, was that we have evolved direct action to substitute fake vulnerability for actual vulnerability and the perception of vulnerability. Like when, you know, people are doing a banner hang, you know, off a crane or a big building, and it like looks really dangerous with somebody like way up there. But if somebody actually knows what they're doing with climbing equipment and knots, they're actually like really safe. So it's like this perception of vulnerability. In the same way with a lot of photo op style civil disobedience, you know, where it looks like a dangerous situation because there's cops there that are arresting people. And, you know, we have this perception of like, whoa, that's dangerous, right? But it's actually like all been coordinated with the cops beforehand, that, you know, people are going to sit in this box and they're going to get two warnings and then they're going to get zip tied and processed and pay their citation down at the station. But what I've found in my own experience then in developing as an activist is that it's actually hard to get yourself back into authentic vulnerability. That it's like, as I've learned as an activist, that, you know, you're supposed to have things like an exit plan and a support structure and, like, you know, a lawyer lined up and all that kind of stuff before you do an action. You know, I've learned those best practices. It's hard to like fake myself back into an authentically vulnerable situation when you know better. And in some ways, that's like the value of youth in this movement and, you know, the value of people who don't know better, that can authentically get themselves in over their heads. And that can be really important. And there's sort of a tension there for elders in the movement to empower that youthful initiative to go like get themselves in over their head and yet be ready to support them as well.
What you're saying though is that it has to be personal. I mean, we're all in a horrible, vulnerable situation, particularly the young people who are coming forward, you know, about the climate crisis. And somehow or another, that, for some reason, that's so abstract to so many people, that vulnerability, that the whole planet. But you're saying that the individual one actually tends to have more power and to bring people in.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what civil disobedience does is it dramatizes subtle vulnerabilities or subtle realities. You know, like in the classic example of the civil rights movement, you know, segregation was a violent form of oppression that was built on violence, but it didn't seem that way to most Americans at the time. you know, there was a huge nationwide poll in 1963 by Newsweek magazine that the results showed that over two-thirds of Americans, almost 70%, said that whites and blacks were treated equally in America. And I think there was a lot of mainstream America that looked at segregation and said, oh, you know, separate water fountains, what's the big deal? It's not like there's actual violence being done to people. And so it wasn't until people transgressed those rules and made it really clear to people that that is a system built on and enforced by violence. And suddenly America was confronted of these images of people getting their heads beaten in and getting, you know, attack dogs sicked on them. And it became really vividly obvious that this in fact was a form of violence. You know, it's something that the later suffrage movement under leaders like Alice Paul did really effectively, where for decades, by like 1913, 1914, in the decades before that, the suffrage movement had been, you know, rather polite in sort of begging for their rights and had built up this ground of sort of comfortable centrist support that said, like, yeah, maybe women should get some more rights one day, but we're not forced to like really make any bold choices. And Alice Paul came into leadership and said, you know, we shouldn't be begging for our rights, we should be demanding our rights and forcing the country to choose between immediate suffrage for women or continued violence and oppression against women, which this system is, and we need to show people that. And so she led people in more confrontational tactics of protests in Washington at a time when that was rare and at a time when it was unheard of for women to be doing it. And they were attacked by police, and the country was confronted with these images of women getting beaten by police, getting dragged across the White House lawn, getting thrown into jail, going on hunger strike and being force-fed in really violent ways. And it suddenly became more obvious and dramatized that the unequal rights for women was in fact a form of violence and was enforced by violence, and forced that comfortable middle ground then to make a choice. And the choice they made was immediate suffrage, and they were able to get that constitutional amendment within a time frame that by 1914, you know, people thought was impossible to have that amendment by the end of the decade. I think in some ways we're in a similar position now, where the work of the environmental movement over the past few decades has built up that comfortable center that says, like, yeah, you know, we should have clean water, and like, yeah, we should have clean air, and, you know, we should do something about reducing emissions someday. But they haven't been forced to make a choice between a drastic reduction of emissions or the continued violence against young people, which is what climate change is. But right now, our country doesn't view climate change as a form of violence against young people.
At Standing Rock, it was violence against young people. Mm-hmm. The leaders were the wisdom keepers for the youth. Mm-hmm. So they turned it on. My question is somewhat about compassion and solidarity. Your key insight into shame was done in prison when you were authentically vulnerable. And there was like a, you know, speaking of the comfort of the bourgeoisie or the baby boomers or the institutions of the university or the churches and all this kind of thing, but that authentic vulnerability and that resiliency that is done among people in prison or the indigenous people, youth, at Standing Rock is a different reality than the professional activists. So how would you address compassion and because you said compassion is different than empathy. Mm-hmm. But if the bourgeoisie would have empathy with the suffering rather than compassion, like, oh, I'm sorry, like some kind of Christian charity, like I want to help you. Like, do you make a distinction between that? Or how is that synthetic union made?
Yeah, so the distinction that I would make is that for the mass of our country, for the bourgeoisie, they haven't even gotten to empathy yet. They failed before they even got to empathy, before they, you know, were actually listening to, paying attention, and authentically connecting with the suffering of marginalized people. And so they need to feel that just to establish that initial connection to the reality of lived experience for marginalized people. The problem within movement spaces, I think, for people who have made that connection through empathy, who have begun to pay attention to the lived experience of people who suffer from oppression, is that we get stuck in it. You know, people who have been awoken by that empathy, who have felt that connection, who have felt called to stand in solidarity and to do something about it, and who show up. Those are the folks that I think that our failure is not that we haven't experienced empathy, but that we get stuck in it. Those are the folks who need to make the turn to compassion. I think there is maybe some degree of a shortcut or something that liberals sometimes take of avoiding that empathy in the first place and just cutting to compassion or sympathy or pity or, you know, something worse than compassion, where they never make that authentic connection and just are like, well, yes, I feel sorry for those people who suffer. And it's sort of an escape path. And so I'm definitely not advocating that. I do think experiencing that empathy and allowing ourselves to actually feel other people's pain is critical and can't be avoided. We shouldn't be shortcutting that to skip right to compassion, but we need to keep moving as well. It's definitely a different recommendation, I think, that I would have, you know, if I wasn't in a store like this and if I was, you know, speaking to a different audience.
So, I mean, I'm trying to draw parallels with the Martin Luther King era and the climate crisis today. I mean, key is what you said, I mean, raising empathy in people, raising the feeling of empathy. And in the King era, you know, we had a media, everybody watched the same media. That no longer happens today. We each are compartmentalized in the media that we watch. So the information system is broken. We don't have a unified information system. Number two, when they let the dogs loose on the activists of the 1950s, here we have, there's no dogs being loosed on us. Standing Rock, sorry. But outside of that, when the violence is being done to young people, you know, by the time they reach our age or my age, the quality of life is going to be substantially worse. And it's all nebulous. It's like a punching bag, but there's no, you can't see the people that we're trying to reach. They cannot see the dangers or the vulnerabilities like they could in the 1950s. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. We have this broken information, bifurcated information system, and this very nebulous effect that's coming down the pike. What the hell do we do? I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah, thank you. So for the first part of that, in terms of the lack of a unified media, that's, I think, absolutely true, and certainly one of the big shifts. And so I'd say, because we don't have a unified political discourse, we don't even have like a unified conception of reality in this country, I think that means we can't afford to have a unified movement either. I think part of the difference in context that we have between now and Dr. King, of that difference in movement, means that we can't have a movement that just follows somebody like Dr. King. That because we have this fractured discourse and this fractured information system, each of us really only has the potential to reach a certain amount of people. But each of us does have the potential to reach some people. We do have a circle of people who listen to us, who notice what happens to us, or who would resonate with our story, even people who don't already know us, but people that we could be connected with, that will see our story. And none of us has a universal circle of people that we could reach and influence, which is why we need a more diversified movement with broader leadership and broader initiative, where everyone can be taking the kinds of actions and telling the kind of story with their own action that can reach the circle of people that they can reach. And, you know, rather than one big strategy with one big message that reaches everyone, I think we're going to need a lot of messages that overlap and reach small circles. And the more that we can empower that diverse leadership and broad initiative, the more powerful that we're going to be. I kind of forget the second part of your question.
Well, so do I. So. Anyway, more of a comment.
Another question over there.
So you did just speak about having a need for a diversity of messages, and kind of just to go back to the wall thing, I guess the problem happens is when someone stops sending their message, stops pushing against the wall to turn and tell you you're sending your own message. I mean, I'm sure you've gotten, you know, you're undermining us, you're making us look like terrorists, you're too extreme. How do you respond to someone telling you you're doing it wrong? What do you say to them?
Well, that is a good question, because sometimes they're right. Like, sometimes I am doing it wrong. So it's a challenge where I think we have to have some dialogue there. You know, that when somebody says, you know, you're doing it wrong, I can't just like blindly listen and, you know, go follow them or whatever, but I can't just ignore them either. Like, there needs to be engagement there, and you know, there needs to be discussion of like, well, what do you see from your spot on the wall? You know, like what are you seeing that I might not be seeing from over here? You know, and if I listen to that and I'm like, well, I already understood that. Like, I can see that from my spot on the wall too. And I still think it makes sense to push in this spot. You know, I keep doing what I'm doing, and we try to continue that dialogue, but I might shift then too. That can be frustrating at times, because it's sometimes hard to trust that critique is in good faith. You know, and if you spend 90% of your time responding to people who are constantly like, you know you're doing it wrong, it's hard to continually step back and be like, okay, well, let's talk about it. I think we need better practices of saying, come with me and we'll talk as we walk here. You know, we need to get better at not necessarily pausing to step back to have a dialogue. Like, we need to tighten up that circle of praxis to where that dialogue and that reflection can happen really within the continued action, and that cycle of praxis spins faster, rather than like, we're going to take a few months to think about things, and then we're going to like throw ourselves into action for a few months until we burn out, and then we're going to, you know, step way back again. You know, it needs to be more seamless, which generally happens like as that cycle keeps spinning. Like, I sometimes talk about the metaphor of riding a bicycle, that dialogue and that reflection and that learning, it's like having your balance on a bicycle, and the action is like pedaling and moving forward. And if you try to get your balance perfect on a bicycle before you stop pedaling, you'll never get anywhere, because you can always fine tune that balance a little bit and you'll always be a little wobbly. But if you think about your balance while you start pedaling forward, the forward momentum aids the balance, and the balance sustains the momentum. You know, and of course, if you don't worry about balance at all, you're going to crash really quickly. And I think the same is true in our activism, that we can do a lot in terms of difficult dialogue, difficult self-work, and difficult internal work when we've got a lot of forward momentum. And when we lose that forward momentum, any little imbalance there can tip us over. You know, just like when you're on a bike and going really fast, you can lean pretty far without falling over, because the balance and the forward momentum sustain each other.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I look around the room here, and I'm not going to speak for everybody, but it looks like we're all white. How do we engage minorities in climate change? How do we get involved in the movement? I know the Sierra Club is like a local one here. It's like the old white club. Basically, how do we get minorities involved?
There's a lot of answers to that, and that's been one of the big questions for the environmental movement over the past like 8 or 10 years. One answer is that we recognize and listen to and connect with the people of color that are doing this work, you know, that have been doing environmental justice work for a long time and continue to do environmental justice work and climate justice work. And, you know, and we elevate those voices within the movement, I think is really important. I think it's also important for us to recognize part of the way that we got to a point of a predominantly white environmental movement and some of the problematic histories within that movement, the chapters of the environmental movement that have been xenophobic or outright racist. You know, I mean, you mentioned the Sierra Club, and in the 1980s, the Sierra Club was taken over by a right-wing faction that was openly xenophobic and anti-immigrant. And we need to have some accountability for that history in order to earn the trust of communities of color. And we need to be structuring our strategies in ways that are in solidarity, you know, which in some ways is more important than having people of color in this room. It's okay if we're not all sitting together holding hands all the time. It's not okay if our strategies undermine their communities and disempower their communities. And so that's what we need to be particularly conscious of and need to be in dialogue with those communities to understand how our actions and how our movements might be impacting those communities. We've done that in the past in this movement.
It's just that a lot of the people that are affected with the environment are the poor, are the people of color, mm-hmm. are, you know, I think they would be fighting more, be more involved.
They're busy. In my dialogue with a lot of activists of color, you know, particularly African Americans over the past few years, when there's been a real moment of opportunity with the Black Lives Matter movement that has been really significant, they'll say, like, you know, make sure you keep this stuff in mind, but like, sorry, I can't be there with you because we've got important stuff going on right now. And, you know, I need to be in this space over here, focusing on Black Lives Matter because we're in a real moment here. You know, it's important to keep that dialogue and that connection open, but also to recognize that, like, we can't be demanding that people step out of their own work to come be, like, the token people of color in our spaces so that we, like, feel like we're being inclusive. And in addition to those that are working on racial justice activism in an all-consuming way and can't necessarily take the time to show up at an environmental issue. You know, also when we're talking about marginalized, impoverished people, they're working a lot more just to put food on the table and don't necessarily have the luxury of showing up. And in part, that's what solidarity is all about. Yeah.
I just want to come back to what you said earlier about the need for diversity within the movement, is that those people are working towards the same issue of justice that we are, mm-hmm. whether we're dealing with the environment or whether we're dealing with, you know, the coal plant, or whether we're dealing with, you know, a neighborhood empowerment. And so I think we need to be very aware right. of each other and support each other, but we're not all going to do the same thing because we're not all coming from the same place. I think
right.
it's important that you said that.
Right. And part of supporting that diversity of approach means not insisting that everything looks like what we would put in the bucket of climate or environmental work. You know, I think one of the beautiful things about Standing Rock was the climate movement did show up in a lot of significant ways, but it didn't try to, at least I'm sure it did in some ways, but overall it didn't necessarily demand that everything had to be framed as a climate and environmental issue. It recognized a lot of the leadership of indigenous communities that were showing up there in Standing Rock and weren't necessarily calling it the struggle for the environment or for climate change, or weren't necessarily focused on like the oil industry itself, but were calling it a struggle for indigenous sovereignty, and we're articulating that message. Part of having that diversity of voices and initiative in the movement is accepting that it's not all going to be in the same language and the same message, but it is going to be part of that same struggle against those same enemies and towards that same vision of a healthy and just future.
There's an organization that I work with called Reevaluation Counseling Community. It's like an international community and work eliminating distress patterns from each other. And we've actually formed a
like a companion organization called Care of the Environment. And the commitment is for the people to do enough emotional work that they can actually look at what's happening honestly to the environment and take action instead of, you know, just giving up or not even looking.
Right.
Just wondered, you know, if that relates to what you were talking about earlier.
I think that's critical. You know, and that's something that the Climate Disobedience Center has been moving more into as well, with a model that we call praxis groups that we see as kind of a merge between the affinity group model and the small group ministry model of people supporting each other in their emotional and spiritual grappling with the nature of this crisis, supporting each other and taking action as well. The one thing that we've found is that we can't get stuck in one or the other for too long. You know, as I was saying before about the bicycle and the cycle of praxis, that doing that emotional work and having a community to do that emotional work within is absolutely critical, but so is taking action, because it is, it is unthinkable. You know, like we never are going to wrap our minds around it to the extent that we have that work done. That's ongoing work that we're going to be doing for the rest of our lives.